Okay, so I gave a talk on last Monday that was really about open system, many-body entanglement, and all of these kind of things. Today I want to talk about something which is conceptually, in terms of theoretical physics, somewhat simpler. I will talk about ultra-cold atoms in superconducting vortex lattices, where the goal is to sort of ask the question: is there life after optical lattices? Well, yeah, you will. We'll see. Okay. Well, it has a question mark, okay, as you can see. And the idea is this, to sort of find or somehow develop ideas to replace optical lattices as a tool for doing many body physics. And this is really about single particle physics here, finding actually trapping potentials. But you will see, I guess, that that the whole discussion by itself is sort of interesting in the sense of a hybrid system that will be a combination of superconducting stuff and atoms. And of course, the whole thing is sort of motivated. Maybe some of you know this Ig Nobel Prize by Geim. Okay, they're trying to do something with atoms. Okay, so they're in very good company here. So the relevant paper is the one down here. Let me give right away reference. So I spent my sabbatical last year, part of the time, July and also January this year, with these guys. There's Ignacio that all of you, I guess, know, and there's Oriol, and he was the main postdoc behind these things, and he was really the key person developing that. And there were two people involved from Barcelona. They are experts for HTC superconductivity. They are sort of really superconducting people that provided all the expertise on the superconducting side. Okay, so let me sort of start out with the basic question that you want to ask. So when we talk about optical lattices here, everybody knows the story: counterpropagating light waves. You got atoms inside. At the end of the day, you get Harvard models out. And of course, the point that I want to make here is this, that you have counterpropagating light waves here. They form at the end an optical lattice, which is the sine square. So it is essentially a spatially modulated periodic potential with a distance, with a lattice spacing, which is lambda over 2, which is the wavelength of the light. And that's very important in the following sense, that if at the end of the day you ask in your Hubbard model that you have down here, how do these parameters here scale? Because they determine the time scales and also the temperature scales. Of course, this hopping parameter that we have in our Hubbard model here, if you look at the band structure, you can see that the width of the band down here is fundamentally limited by the inequality, which is written here. There's what we call the recoil energy in an optical lattice. There's the mass in here, and there's the K vector, which is related to the wavelengths of the light up here. And given the recoil energy that we have for an atom, given the mass and the corresponding wavelength for the optical lattice, of course, this hopping matrix element is always much, much smaller than this ER, or smaller than the ER. So if you do another iteration sort of based on the Hubbard model over here, and you talk about, say, exchange interactions, then there will be a second order in this T. That will be T squared divided by U. T over U is here a small quantity, and U is maybe the interactions that we have over here. This sets the energy scale for, say, magnetism that we want to have. And of course, at the end, the temperature has to be much smaller than this thing over here. And of course, the additional requirement also comes in that any decoherence timescales or rates that come in, of course, also have to be on this side. So you can see that we have here a whole chain of inequalities that are very fundamental. And if you want to do some exotic physics with these Hubbard models, of course, you have to move all the way down here and satisfy these inequalities. So it's quite obvious that you might ask yourself, can we sort of, given that we have certain temperatures, but on this inequality side, you would like to go in these exotic Hubbard models to, smaller and smaller energy scales here, can we build something like sub-wavelength lattices to effectively reduce this K over here in our whole argument, therefore raising, this energy scale and then making this whole inequality here, much, much better in terms of the given temperatures that are available at the moment. And there's different ways of doing that. I think it's a very important point because, at the moment we are reaching the point where, getting the low temperatures, say, for magnetism is a very big challenge. And so if you are able to change this inequality by multiplying this thing by some factor, say, instead of the wavelengths, over 2, you might something like the wavelengths over a quarter, you win already a factor of, 4 in this case over here. So if you go to much smaller spacings, even you might win much more. So in this sense, the obvious question is, can we scale down the lattice to something like, say, a sub-wavelength lattice? And there's different answers to this. And one of them I will then also discuss in the following. But let me just first review a little bit what ideas were that we and also others discussed in this context. The one, maybe rather obvious idea is to let the atom make a nonlinearity, which at the end of the day comes down to doing a sub-wavelength lattice. I just give you an example of a paper that we had in New Journal of Physics. There was some other work together with Misha Lukin's group that talked about sub-wavelength addressing. That's not what I talk about here. But sort of here, the basic idea is this, that if I take an alkaline earth atom as an example, ground in excited state, this can be in the two metastable states, then you get sort of naturally spin or actually a state-dependent lattice like this over here. Imagine now that you put on some sidebands in this laser. What the sidebands of the laser do is this, that they couple this upper and the lower curves here together. And then, you know, if the coupling here is sufficiently large, there will be little avoided crossings over here. And if you chain all of these things together, you get a structure like this thing out. You get structures that are very sub-wavelength structures that, of course, can serve as a sub-wavelength optical lattice. So here the atom sort of provides by itself a nonlinearity that can be, in this sense, sub-wavelengths, because the standard lattice is just the linear response of your system. And this can be realized in this context. Another way of doing something along these lines would be to think, well, can we sort of make, we call it here, self-assembled dipolar crystals of molecules. This maybe would belong more to the other program here at the moment. As floating nanostructure, the idea says that, imagine that we have polar molecules here, and we're able to do something like a crystal. Of course, another atom or another molecule, you know, that maybe on the different layer over here, will see, of course, the structure under it by providing a modulation, and therefore it can provide a structure which acts like an optical lattice, or which acts like a lattice for these extra particles going around here. And as a consequence, you know, depending on what kind of a lattice spacing one is able to make over here, one is able to have sort of a floating structure of polar molecules, the periodic structure, and then on top you got these atoms or these other molecules that do the Hubbard models. The interesting part in the story is this, that it's easy to change, of course, the lattice spacing here, because you can change the size, the lattice spacing of your crystal by external parameters. And of course, you know, when you got another atom or molecule hopping around in this whole thing here, there will be phonons, and these are simply the phonons provided by the overall lattice oscillation. So this is an interesting version of doing not only Hubbard models, but also doing phonons inside of Hubbard models. And we wrote about some of these things also here some time ago. Okay, so another sort of, you know, completely orthogonal way to approach the problem is to talk about hybrid systems in the sense of going very close to surfaces. Yep. So this is sort of near field, you know, that gives you small scales and distances, that solves the sub-wavelength problem by going in close to surfaces, and then also using nanostructuring. The obvious problem in this context is, of course, very clearly that if you go close to surfaces, there will be decoherence. And this is something which at the end of the day must be carefully evaluated in the sense of these inequalities that we had here earlier. Here's an example, you know, of some work that that I participated in, again, as part of my sabbatical last year. This was with Misha Lukin's group at Harvard, where Michael Gallen sort of worked out the problem where you take little nanoplasmonic particles over here, you know, little nanospheres. You can see the dimensions that one talks about here, puts them on the surface. And it's kind of an interesting problem in the sense that if you take light and you scatter this thing, this is indicated over here, and there's an incident light wave. This thing is like a dipole. This dipole oscillates, and of course the light, the electric field emitted by this dipole will interfere with the incident light. And if you play around with these plasmonic resonances, I mean, this is this alpha deployability which is in here, which is the response of your nanosphere. You can sort of play around with these plasmonic resonances, which put this denominator here to zero. And if you go to the blue side, there will be a pi phase shift, and as a consequence, there will be little traps that can appear over here, and one can use them to trap atoms. So at Harvard, there are some experiments ongoing at the moment that are trying to do trapping along sort of this general line of ideas, but there's also experiments that are listed down here in Tübingen that talked about these things. Very clearly, one talks about that. It's a very interesting system. It's sort of a strongly coupled atom plasmonic system. And it has sort of, you know, good things and maybe other things that are opportunities, you know? Like coherent interaction via the plasmonic nanostructure. You know, you can ask things like, if I have an atom over here, maybe these nanospheres sort of talk to each other, and there may be a spin-spin interaction effectively coming out from this whole thing, which allows for engineers and you maybe interesting spin-spin models in this context. But of course, all of these things, in particular, you know, in the plasmonic structure, there will be decoherence from dissipation. So in these plasmonic structures, there will always be relatively large damping, and at the end, it becomes then the question, you know, how the good Bard to the bad Bard scales, and this was done in this paper by Michael Palencier. Okay, what I will talk about today is sort of an effort in a completely different direction, you know, based on this work by Oriol, Romero Saab, where we are trying to do a purely magnetic setting and where we like to use superconductors. And it seems to me that in terms of the numbers and so on, this is a system which, at least on the piece of paper, sounds very interesting. And I'm sort of quite enthusiastic and optimistic about this whole story, and I'd like to tell you now the following slides, I mean, what the physics ideas are. It's really single particle physics we talk about here, so there's nothing fancy. The Harvard sort of comes on top then in terms of the great parameters that come out.
If you want to get the lattice to be smaller and smaller, what about just going to shorter and shorter wavelengths?
Well, at one point, of course, you start ionizing. I mean, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, but I think it's a question then you are competing with ionization. I've thought about these things before and had a long discussion with Emanuel Bloch at one point. If one can simply take, you know, very short wavelengths, you know, but the question of ionization and then exciting, maybe some whatever, you know, and not only ionizing, but maybe some energy, all of these things come in. It's a question of numbers at the very end. But maybe you're right, you know, that this could be a very interesting possibility, you know, in view of all of these light developments that are in the UV and so on. Yeah, I agree. So the idea is this, that one has an array of holes. They're called antidots in this community, I learned, with vortices that create a magnetic field to trap atoms. And this is sort of schematically indicated over here. And in the following, I would like to tell you now how these fields actually look like in this setup, and how we at the end get atomic traps, and what the typical parameters are, and why this makes one optimistic in terms of all of the numbers. Because I said at the very end of the day, it comes down to estimating the decoherence that comes from, you know, introducing the surface over here, and this kind of a trapping, in combination, you know, with the gain that you have in the energy scales and time scales from your Harvard model. I emphasize that it's also kind of interesting by itself, because this is purely magnetic trapping. There's no laser involved over here. Usually when people see no laser, they feel that they're out of business. But on the other hand, no laser also means that maybe the whole problem is much more quiet. To some extent, you might say that laser, you know, the coherence state that we have in the laser, somehow replaced by the superconductivity. So the superconducting properties of these things offer new opportunities, and there can be, you know, a world of purely magnetic, maybe very quiet kind of a manipulation, but things like spontaneous emission that you might have in an optical lattice might at the end actually, you know, be eliminated in this way. So at the end it becomes a question of numbers, and we will see that. So I guess you probably don't know so much, I mean, about superconducting vortices in thin films, and there's a few slides. And I should say right away that some of these slides are collected from a talk that Oriol gave recently. And so these things are sort of a mixture of his slides and slides that I put together. Okay, the idea is now to use a type 2 superconductor. And I guess most of you know that this is, you know, the external applied field. You know, this is the temperature here. There will be a region with a mixed state which allows vortices. You know, this is sort of, you know, the typical photographs that you have. It is vortices in these type 2 superconductors. So this is a plot down here. You know, this is, for example, that this is the background density. There's a vortex core in here. The relevant parameters in these type 2 superconductors is, first of all, the London penetration depth, lambda. This will play an important role in the following. The correlation length, this is usually very small in the systems, at least the ones to be interested in. As a matter of fact, to get type 2 superconductors, you need lambda divided by this psi to be much larger than 1. So effectively, you know, you put this thing to 0 when you do it, then the so-called London theory of type. Another relevant quantity is the corresponding flux that you have in each of these vortices. This is quantized. It's simply H divided by 2E, the charge of your Cooper pair. And this is 10 to the minus 15 Tesla meter square. At the end, this quantity will sort of, you know, determine what's the, when we do our vortex lattice, you know, what the corresponding energies scales are for the magnetic fields that we will get in these lattices here. We'll come back to these numbers afterwards. So what's now different if one takes a thin film? A thin film is sort of defined by the fact, well, normally you have that this London penetration depth lambda is sort of, you know, much larger than its psi over here. But now imagine that you make a very thin film, and the thin film over here has a certain you know, thickness that we call d, and we want this to be less than this lambda. In this context, a new scale emerges, a new length scale emerges. This is a lambda scale divided by lambda square divided by d, which is this lambda over here, capital lambda. And if you do the London theory of your superconductivity to work out what these vortices are, what you have to solve is sort of the Faraday's law, you know, that the curl of B is equal to the current. Now the current is the one here given in the superconductor by, of course, this expression here, psi star psi. This is the wave function that we would have of your, so to say, Cooper pairs. You know, e to the I phi would be a phase. This would be a vortex that you have. If you put this thing in here, you can see from the gradient, you're first of all picking up a term, and this term over here is the part which will at the end be sort of the source of the magnetic field, which is like a monopole, as will turn out in the following discussion. And of course, this part over here, this A, is just usually, you can see this 1 over lambda is the familiar discussion that we have of this penetration depth in these thin films, which in this case, you know, sets the energy, the length scale lambda over here, you know, given by this expression over here. So in the bulk medium would be lambda, lowercase lambda, and here would be capital lambda, which is a little bit larger than the lambda over here. These will be the relevant scales, and at the end we will see that, you know, we will be able to make lattices, or sort of nano-engineer lattices that will be a scale over here. And all of these parameters that appear here are sort of in the nanometer regime. And I think it is quite realistic to have something like this, to have the lattices at the end that we will discuss in the following, where there will be the lattice spacing sort of larger than this thing over here, maybe 100 nanometers, but it can also be down to something like maybe 20 nanometers if you're a little bit more optimistic. So this is the current that would flow around, you know, in the superconductive material according to this expression down here. So at that point, you have to work out what magnetic fields are, you know, that you have here, these vortices. The magnetic fields are here written above the surface. You can see that this would be here, sort of the your thin sheet would be in here. Here is the point of your vortex, and here you can see all of the field lines going out, and this simply comes by solving these equations. And this was done a long time ago, and this is called the Pearl vortex. But I would like to give you now a little bit intuitive feeling behind these things and what it means at the very end in terms of constructing a corresponding trap. If you look at the upper part over here, you know, it looks sort of like a magnetic charge, you know, like the magnetic field that would come from a monopole, which it turns out to be actually sitting somewhere down here. This is sort of drawn over here. As a matter of fact, if you take this expression here, this is the expression for the magnetic field. You can see this integration dk over here, which somehow is off here. If you rewrite this first expression, you can rewrite this thing in a somewhat different form. And the conclusion from all of these things is that actually this field over here is to an excellent approximation, the one of a monopole, which sits below the sheet here a certain distance. And this distance, you know, is, well, sort of, you know, gives you then the center for the monopole. So in the following discussion, it will turn out to be an excellent approximation to approximate the magnetic field by something which is really a monopole that can be simply be understood of having a magnetic charge, which is down here, that creates then the corresponding field. This allows us to derive then all of these analytical formulas that come out at the very end. Okay, there's two more ingredients that we have to talk about. Namely, what we're going to do in the following is to drill little holes in these thin superconducting films. And then you have to talk about, you know, what's the interaction energy between between a vortex and one of these holes that one has over here. To what extent are they attractive? Because the idea at the very end will be to do some sort of a nanostructuring by drilling little holes, and then to sort of pin the vortices in these holes, and there will be a certain binding energy, an energy associated, you know, with that these vortex would like to go to this hole. These things have been worked out, and it turns out that these holes are attractive, provided that the radius of this hole that one can drill over here is, for example, larger than the correlation length that one has over here. And the other part is this, that one is to talk about vortex-vortex interactions here. There's some very general formulas. Again, what comes out at the very end of the day is this, that there will be vortex-vortex interactions that can be very easily understood, like magnetic charges that interact with each other, provided you are sort of in the far field regime, namely that the distance between these vortices are larger than the lambda. This will be the regime that we will be in afterwards. And so the question is then, you know, if I give you now holes and a set of vortices that might appear naturally by applying a certain field, you know, can I pin these things here to these holes that I'm nanostructuring then the answer will be, well, it can be pinned, provided that the distance, you know, are sort of larger or equal than this lambda that one has over here. So this competition between pinning, between holes, and on the other hand, a natural, you know, arc-recurse of vortex lattice that you might get is sort of, you know, set by this scale, which is given by this lambda. Here are some examples, you know, from the literature. If you do this pinning and vortex lattice, you know, if you do, for example, a large spacing lattice, this would be a standard arc-recurse of lattice that you have down here, as you can see, triangular. If you, for example, drill now little holes in all of these things, try to make a square lattice out of the triangular one, depending on what the density of these vortices is that you have, you would either have these vortices sitting here in all of these holes, this is what we want at the very end, or of course, if you try to put in too many vortices over here, there will be sort of a phase transition or some rearrangement that they would like to, at the end, sort of go over to the triangular lattice that we had down here. So we want to be in the regime here, where the densities of the vortices that we have would be sort of comparable, you know, to this distance over here, which has to be larger than the distance capital lambda that we identified before as a thin film penetration depth. So there will be a density of vortices. They can be loaded by field cooling. So what you do is at the beginning you apply a magnetic field, and then you cool these things down, and then you can actually switch the magnetic field off, and then these vortices essentially stay pinned, and this seems to be a standard technique in this whole community, what they do. And there will be vortex lattices in these thin films, and these kind of things can have been discussed here in terms of these phase diagrams that exist over here. The last remark about these vortices is this. At the end of the day, when we discuss now magnetic traps based on these kind of ideas, is this that we have to ask ourselves, what are the imperfections in our system? And this will be related to the fact that there will be vortex dynamics, kind of a thermal jiggling of these vortices. They are pinned, of course, by these holes. But of course, thermal fluctuations, which are these fluctuations which are up here, this FT, you know, there will be a random force. This is like Brownian motion. They will sort of undergo a little bit Brownian motion. And the combination of all of this will be that there's an overdamped motion of the position of the vortex, which is pinned. This is sort of a restoring force, this Kp over here, which at the end, you know, the ratio of this Kb divided by this damping eta that we have will set a certain frequency scale, like this 10 to the 11 hertz that we have over here. So that's very fast, very large. But at the end of the day, this kind of a vortex motion will set sort of, you know, the frequency scale, and also the strength of the heating that we will get in an optical lattice is simply this thermal kind of a jiggling of this vortex, you know, when it moves, it tries to be pinned, but at the same time, you know, thermal forces according to this Brownian motion are trying to push these things around. Again, this seems to be something which is well established in this community there, and what you get out at the end is this, that the vortex will sort of fluctuate, and this is the relevant correlation function. You can see that it goes down here exponentially with this omega d, which was this pinning frequency that I wrote over here. So essentially, this is a very large frequency on all of the time scales that we're interested in the case of atoms. So now you're experts on thin film vortices, and now we want to move on and sort of think to what extent we can use these kind of ideas for nanoscale magnetic lattice for ultra-cold atoms. This is again the picture that I had at the very beginning over here. You can see the little holes that we drill, and we have applied this magnetic field, and then, you know, frozen, then lowered the temperature, got in all of these vortices, and we assume to be pinned at this point, and as I said, it will sort of thermally fluctuate around a little bit. Let's now construct a little magnetic trap which uses this thing, so that at the end of the day we get some Harvard models out for this whole thing. And I guess most of you know atomic physics, know that when we do magnetic traps, we have some magnetic moment, you know, which is sort of parallel to the instantaneous direction of the magnetic field. When the particle moves around, it will adiabatically follow that. And this is a relevant expression, and you want to have weak field seekers in order to trap atoms. So a magnetic lattice will at the end of the day just become a question of engineering the proper magnetic field structure over here, which has then a minimum somewhere, not supposed to be zero, because then you have Majorana losses in terms of spin flips and so on. So you want the minimum here in order to trap these atoms similar to this frog that we have seen at the very beginning. So I guess that the frog is also diamagnetic and therefore a weak field seeker. Okay, so this is a more illustrative picture now, what we have to do. You can see that I talked about a single vortex. We had these little holes that were in here, this one and this one. And we can understand the magnetic field essentially as being a monopole, which is now displaced a certain distance down here. And you know, this thing up here is now the corresponding magnetic charge. And what the first thing that we have to do is simply to sum up, you know, all of these vortices and work out the corresponding vortex field that will exist up here as a function, you know, of this distance. And then ask ourselves if we find minima. The answer is we will not find minima. Instead, what we have to do is this. The field sort of, you know, dies down and becomes more and more homogeneous the more you go out here along the z-axis. So what we have to do is this, that we have to apply a B field in the other direction. This field B1 over here, it doesn't have to be very large in order not to introduce more vortices or disturb the one that we have over here. So that the combination of this field, you know, that goes up and the one that goes down gives us at a certain point minima, like the one that we have over here. But at that point, we will get field zeros. And then, of course, you use the standard trick of the top trap to simply, you know, move this by another, you know, transverse field over here. You move the zero that we get here around a little bit, and as a consequence, like in a top trap, you will get an overall field as a combination from all of them, which now becomes very nice harmonic oscillators that are now coupled by this kind of a tunnel coupling, which is indicated over here. So just to indicate briefly, the magnetic field created by this array of vortices, you know, is sort of the one written here. First of all, we assume, but this is not really absolutely necessary, that you have a periodic structure. Actually, it may be very interesting to create also some non-periodic structure, because we want vortices to be you know, pinned at these different holes that we have. And this can be nanostructured in any form that you want. And so it can be interesting to have some periodic structure, but maybe also want something non-periodic to maybe make little pipelines or whatever in order to do, you know, what you have in mind. Well, if you make this monopole approximation that I said, you know, we can think of this thing, magnetic field, to be generated like you have a magnetic charge down here. And then it's quite obvious you have to solve Poisson equation, you know, the Poisson equation, you know, you're outside the thin field, you know, can always be written in terms of the gradient of some scalar potential that we have. And of course, now these sources are sort of the charges which sit now down here. And they are this periodic array, and it's now quite simple to solve all of these things. The consequence of doing this will be that you find now that there will be a magnetic field over here. This is the one created by the vortex in this upper layer, and there's some expression. So the first thing that you should see is this, that this thing falls off sort of exponentially and over a certain distance over here. So this goes down, and at the end of the day, very far up there, the field will be homogeneous and given by a field B naught. What's this field B naught? The field B naught that we have here is simply sort of the flux that we have, this unit flux divided by A square, and A square is the lattice spacing squared. You know, the lattice spacing was here A. And, you know, this number has to be made, of course, compatible with the typical numbers that we have for the atomic traps, and indeed for something like maybe 100 nanometers or smaller, they are definitely exact in the regime where the standard atomic physics trapping always happens. Okay, you can also see that this is a Fourier series, so you're always used to seeing optical lattices as something which is only, you know, a single sign function over here. Turns out that this is, of course, a superposition of many of them. That's your whole Fourier series. So you get things that are non-sinal soidal dependents here that allows you to make really higher order Fourier components, which can be interesting by itself. Okay, so this can be written at the end of the day in this form, and the rest, I guess, already explained over here. Okay, so now we have to get a minimum, okay? So we want trapping at a certain position, which is up here. We call this position now C naught. And so what we do is this, that we apply another external field that comes in the other direction. Remember that we sort of switched on for the vortices the field at the beginning, that we froze this thing. So the vortices were trapped, and then we were switching this thing off. So now we are applying another field, but it goes in a different direction. And the consequence of this will be that there will be a minimum now. This field is sort of decaying up here. You know, along these lines here, it only has a C component. This will be compensated at a certain point over here. There's no transverse component if you go, if you just, you know, go straight up here from this hole that you have. And as a consequence, what you will find is this, that of course there's a maximum field strength allowed, because if you make your field too strong, you will introduce more vortices, and that's not really what we want. So there's a maximum field strength which is allowed. And at the end of the day, what you get now is this, we can sort of, you know, by choosing B1, which was the second field that we explored externally, B0 was the field that came out naturally, was generated by the vortices, the asymptotic field that we had. You know, you pick now some number, like if you take B1 divided by B0, some number larger than zero, say something like the 2 over here, you can now read off over here what the corresponding delta is, but delta is nothing else, it tells you the position essentially in units of this A, which was the lattice spacing, where these you know, minima appear. And this is a corresponding plot over here, what you will find in this region. So you know, you can sort of move these things up and down. When in the case of an optic lattice, we of course change the light intensity to make the lattice deeper and shallower and so on. We can do things in a very similar way over here, that this is sort of a control of your lattice parameters by just changing the corresponding magnetic field. There's actually a second solution down here, which is repulsive. You know, these holes here become the repulsive down here. So if you're interested in making something like a pinball machine for cold atoms, you know, you have to go down here. This will be close to the surface. This is also the regime where things like these higher Fourier components come into play, which by themselves, I guess, are sort of kind of interesting. What's this thing over here? Okay. Okay, and then the last ingredient that we need is that we need a transverse field, because we got these zeros over here, and we have to now do the top trap trick of you know, sort of wiggling these zeros around in order to do that. And again, this is sort of standard now, you just add a transverse field. And you know, and the bottom line story is this, that it will be an effective total field that comes out over here when you do the harmonic averaging. And then the consequence of all of this is that there will be a total lattice field over here. So we have generated something which is like a magnetic lattice here, that, you know, is the combination of all of these things, and there's a lot of control in these parameters, very similar to what we have for the optical lattices, except that I'm really emphasizing that these distances that we have here can be very, very small. Okay, this is the analytical approximation, and the Barcelona experts, of course, have all of their numerics ready to do some, you know, small-scale real calculations based on these London equations, and to do some real, you know, boundary value solving of all of that. You can see this is a simple approximation. This is just a small array, something like 3x3 numerical. You can see that in the center, you know, these are edge effects that we have over here. This thing looks actually pretty similar. So we guess that these analytical approximations that one has here actually do a really good job. Okay, here you can see these effects of these non-harmonic approximations. You can see that, you know, if you go to these distances of very large distances from the surface, it becomes essentially harmonic, like what we know in the case of optical potentials. And if you come closer, you get these very sort of more like delta function like spikes, you know, kind of a chronic panic model that you can do with these atoms over here. Okay, so this then, of course, now is a trap. And then you can ask yourself, what about your Hubbard Hamiltonians? I mean, how do they scale in all of this? And in particular, I mean, what's the ratio of hoppings that we would have at an atom that's hopping around between all of that? No, how do all of these things scale? And I mean, how does the heating go, and how do imperfections enter the whole story? Again, I mean, this is standard optical lattice results. So this is sort of reformulated in a way that it looks like an optical lattice. You know, that if I take only the harmonic component at the moment, there will be a certain strength V0 over here. This K has to do with the wave factor and has to do with the lattice spacing that we have here. And of course, we have here now this formula, recoil energy introduced before, trapping frequency. This is the oscillation frequency around, that tells you the distance between the Bloch bands. But then we have here these tunneling rates, standard formulas, you know, from optical lattices and the corresponding on-site repulsion, which involves now here the scattering length of your ground state atoms. Of course, you can do these things for bosons and fermions and so on. So it's sort of standard magnetic trapping. You need, of course, wheat field seekers to do that. Okay, so in a superconducting vortex lattice, all of these things are very similar. The energy scale of the depths of the lattice is set by this parameter here, B naught square divided, and this was our transverse field that was sort of washing out the zeros in order to avoid the Majorana losses. And you can see that if you go further and further away from the distance, you know, with our minimum, then of course the corresponding delta comes in, so this thing is exponentially suppressed in here, which means that in practice that what you get is this allows you to change the depths of your lattice, you know, and choose the number of Bloch bands that you want to have in order to do your physics. So if you want to do a mod insulator, superfluid mod insulator transition for bosons, you would simply have to change this parameter over here and change the corresponding distance. But there's this translation table now, of course, that we have here, the nanostructured holes, you know, that are sort of now analog of the wavelengths over here. Yeah. And
we're rapidly running out of time.
Okay, I'm finished soon.
Okay.
Okay, good. So the interesting part is now to look at numbers that come out over here in terms of, for example, the hopping. And if you take a conservative value for this lambda, something like 100 nanometers, okay, and you take now A divided by lambda, this is the lattice spacing, which should be larger than the lambda over here. You can see what the hoppings over here are. I mean, you know, one is for rubidium, the other one for lithium. If you look at these numbers, I mean, this is very exciting. You know, when I see something like 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 in terms of hertz for these hoppings, then this is, of course, much larger than what we have at the moment, and maybe then also the stepping stone for the new physics. If you're optimistic, you can go down to 20 nanometers, and you can see that now it gets really great. I mean, if I see these numbers over here, for example, you know, then these are really fantastic values. Okay. And of course, you know, this is sort of a typical number that we find in the literature. So something like, you know, 40 nanometer for the lambda penetration depths is sort of a good thing up here. Decoherence, a few slides about this. There will be two mechanisms. One will be heating of the motion degrees of freedom, and the other one will be spin flips. And as I said, you have this model of these vortex fluctuations, you know, Brownian motion, and you put all of these things in, and at the end of the day, you get certain formulas out here that, of course, you scale with the temperature. If you go low in temperature, you win, of course, at that point. But the interesting part is this, that if you look at the corresponding decoherence over here, then you find that the decoherence rate are about the factor of maybe 100 or even 1,000, you know, better than the time scales that we get for the corresponding hopping here. So all of these things look, I think, good. Sort of a not so great message is this, that if you make an error in the positioning of your vortices, this is filling the nano holes, you know, even a very low error, I mean, introduces actually quite significant fluctuations. So this is maybe the major drawback over the whole scheme, but on the other hand, these vortices can also interact, so to some extent there could also be some sort of a self-healing. If you want to make a triangular lattice, I mean, just leave out the holes and take an apicose of lattice directly. And but in general, this positioning of the vortices is something which is a non-trivial dependence here. Last slide now, really, on this all magnetic toolbox. You can ask, can you do single side addressing in the systems? And one way of doing this would be to have an SDM tip down here, a magnetic tip, and because these are thin films, essentially the message at the end of the day is this, that you can shift a single atom up there by an extra little magnetic tip that you have down here. And again, the numbers for the sort of this local addressing of your system look good. With this, let me now conclude, okay? So these, you know, scales here on the nanometer regime, and one is exploiting now both the quietness of superconductivity and magnetic field trapping to make now nanostructured lattices here. And our hope is this, that, you know, whenever there's end, you know, of an optical lattice due to some fundamental reasons, you know, maybe these lattice spacing, temperature requirements, all of these kind of things, maybe in parallel, you know, one could try to take some first baby steps towards developing ideas like this in the lab, which at the very end, I think, sound very promising in terms of, you know, this combination of nanoengineering together with these atomic physics. What we are not exploiting here at the moment is we're taking the vortices as really classical vortices. Would be interesting to think about quantum vortices. You know, these atoms can also be interesting probes for these kind of things that are going here, on here and so on. Of course, there's some AMO issues. There's no lasers allowed here. At least if you apply a laser, there will be, you will destroy superconductivity, but of course it will recover if you do strong cooling. So the loading, of course, you could done by sort of, you know, pulling atoms from a magnetic trap, which is further away in. The measurement is sort of another issue. Of course, if you want to do standard AMO measurement, you would sort of put this thing upside down and then simply drop the atoms and then want to measure them when they fly down, and once you're far away, of course, you're allowed to use the laser then there. Okay, so this is sort of the idea, and would be interesting to combine some of the quantum features down here of superconductivity with this kind of a trapping, but use this thing as an interface, maybe do some, you know, superconducting quantum device that could live down here, but that's maybe for next time. Okay.
So this is, of course, very reminiscent of the old ideas we had with these permanent magnetic structures, but it seems, of course, a much improved version. One reason is, you know, the surface is low temperature, so lower anticoherence. But, I mean, do you have an estimate how the trapping frequency here compares to the one that you could achieve in such permanent structures there?
Well, you know, as I said before, you know, we were able to, for a typical parameters, we were able to get maybe something like a few Bloch bands in here. And, you know, when you see a hopping wave, which is 10 to the 3, 4, 5, like hertz or so, then, you know, multiply these things by a factor of 10 or 50 or something like this, and then you get the corresponding optical, not the Schumann,
but now you have comparing to optical lattices.
Bloch waves, okay.
But this is comparing to optical lattices, right?
No, this is comparing here. I mean, no. This thing was sort of designed in terms of parameters to be completely analogous to the optical lattices in terms of how you parameterize all of that. And then
my question is, I mean, what if you would realize the same all magnetic idea with some, you know,
You would get huge decoherence rates, first of all. I mean, this is the main advantage of the scheme over here. And no, and I think that this says it all. So you really win in terms of decoherence.
So I have two questions. The first question is, can you actually change your hopping T? Because you have to change your trapping, basically the vortex strength, right? So can this be done in the system? So this is the first
Yes,
one.
You can do it. And as I said before, you know, I can change the depth of your lattice. And this is sort of the Bloch band that he talked about before.
But simply, if you have to change basically how much vortex is trapped in each of the pins,
no, but I mean, this, you know, where this minimum is, okay, and the depth of the optical lattice, you know, scales, you know, if I go away, okay, so there will be the following parameters. There will be the vortices that create asymptotically a certain E field. Okay, you compensate with the other one, and I can change that. In this sense, I'm able to move the minimum around, and it can go further away, then it becomes more and more shallow.
Yeah. So the next question is, when you basically those fabrication of those pins, so the parameter spreads of the pin size and also distance can be like 5% different in basically current technology. The question is, does does this mean that it's actually better to use like the self-formed like vortex arrays instead of using the pin, basically to make a better lattice?
I think that this is definitely a good answer. Okay, I mean 5% is probably too much over here, except if you like to study this order. There's a lot of people out there that like this order. And I would agree with that. So taking a standard Aricosov lattice, at that point, of course, you're restricted to triangular lattices. But if you take these ideas of this local addressing, then of course it would allow you to eliminate certain lattice sites, and then you get interesting other lattices around for that.
Okay. Do we have time for one more question? Okay. Fire, like, we'll leave it there.
I have a quick Ian. So the electric field due to an electric monopole falls off like 1/r². Why does the B field fall off exponentially?
There's an interference of, it doesn't fall off. I mean, asymptotically, it goes to a certain value.
Well, you showed an exponential decay.
But it was the combination of all of these sine function, you know, together with the other one. So it's really the sum of all of these things which together give that. I mean, and this is simply solving London equation at the very end. You talk about near field effects now, and you have to solve London equation, which is not standard electromagnetism, but we have to solve, you know, for the superconducting current, which has this penetration depth in there. So the formulas are different because of this, you know, 1/λ vector potential type term.
Okay.
Just in the